Welcome to Girls Night, the go-to podcast for women in their everything era. That wildly confusing decade-ish where we have to make many of the most significant decisions of our lives all at the same time. Career, marriage, motherhood, and more. Well, thankfully, we don't have to do it alone. I'm your host, Stephanie Mae Wilson, and each week on the show, I interview some of the world's wisest women on the topics that keep us up at night. You'll walk away from each episode with both clarity and confidence, knowing what your next step is and also how to take it. After all, the best girls' nights aren't just about eating pizza and sweatpants with your friends. They're about problem solving and leaning into the collective wisdom of women. And that's what this show is all about. Pull up a seat. We're so glad you're here. Let's get started. So friend, I'm so excited about today's episode. Today, we're talking about why your 20s are some of the most important years of your life and how you can make the most of them. Note, I'm not in my 20s anymore, and I still loved this episode. So note, this is not just for 20-somethings. To walk us through this, I invited none other than the 20-somethings expert herself, Dr. Meg Jay. Meg Jay is a clinical psychologist and author who specializes in 20-somethings. I read her book, The Defining Decade, honestly, probably a decade ago, and it changed my life. She actually has a new book releasing this week called The 20-Something Treatment, which is all about young adult mental health, and I cannot wait for you to hear more about it. In our conversation, Meg is teaching us why the 20-something years are so critical in shaping who we are. Along with that, she's sharing her research on the young adult mental health crisis in America and her best solutions for improving your mental health and just your life in general. My hope is that you'll walk out of this episode feeling less alone, knowing that it's totally normal to struggle with life in your 20s. But also, I hope you walk away feeling so much better equipped to take your next steps forward. You don't have to do this alone. Okay, you ready? Here's my conversation with Meg. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. As many of you know, I recently wrote a book, and while it was the most rewarding project of my career so far, it also came with a lot of hard work and long nights. And sometimes when things started to feel a little bit overwhelming, I needed to get a few things off my chest so I could clear my mind and keep the writing process flowing. And the thing that helped me so much to sort through those feelings was therapy. Now tell me if any of this sounds familiar. Maybe you're going through something really hard right now, a big loss or a gigantic life transition. Maybe you frequently feel anxious, depressed, overwhelmed, or just generally discouraged. Maybe you really, really, really want your life circumstances to change, but you don't know how to actually change them. Or maybe you're feeling stuck as you try to work through your past, navigate your present, or figure out your future. Friend, if you can relate to any of this, you're not alone. I've been there, and therapy has been the thing that has helped me more than anything else with all of this. In the last 10 years or so, I've learned that strength isn't proving I can do it on my own. It's knowing that I don't have to. I'm at my strongest when I have a full support system around me, and an essential part of my support system is therapy. Therapy can be absolutely life-changing. That is, if you can afford it and find a therapist you like and trust. But of course, this is easier said than done. And that's why I'm so excited to be partnering with this week's podcast sponsor. Our sponsor for today's episode is BetterHelp. BetterHelp is the easiest and most affordable way I've ever found to find a great therapist. It's entirely online and super easy to sign up. You can get started right away. And if you don't love the counselor you're paired with, switching is easy and it's free. If you're going through something hard in your relationships, or if you're in a funk you just can't shake, if you've been feeling anxious or depressed lately, or if you're feeling stressed and you need help balancing your everyday life and schedule, BetterHelp is an incredible resource for you. And I'm so thankful that they've given me a promo code that I can share with you to make it even easier to get started. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/friendship today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/friendship. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Friends, springtime is finally here, but that also means allergy season is in full swing. I have always struggled with allergies, and I don't know about you, but I am especially allergic to cats. More on that in a second. Well, luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. The time that I use Claritin the absolute most is when I'm at my parents' house, my childhood home. They have this absolutely beautiful cat that they love and I like, except for the fact that he sheds so much. So that means that I'm basically sneezing from the second I arrive home to the second I leave, unless I take Claritin. My dad has even started having it ready for me right when I walk in the door. Are you ready to live life as though you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. Claritin, thank you so much for sponsoring our girls' night. We love having you. Friends, I am like just over the moon about who we have here on the show today. I'm sitting here with my new friend, if I may be so bold, Dr. Meg J. And I, well, Dr. J, Meg, as you said, I could call you. Tell me, tell us who you are, what you do, and a fun fact about yourself.
Okay. My name is Meg J. I'm a clinical psychologist and I specialize in 20-somethings. I wrote The Defining Decade and The 20-Something Treatment, which we'll talk about today. Fun fact about me, which is 20-something related, is that when COVID broke out, I was in the South China Sea with 520-somethings, and we were stranded at sea after that until, well, for a good couple months.
A good couple months?
Yeah. So
Were you on semester at sea or something?
Yeah, I was. I was teaching on semester at sea. I was teaching positive psychology, of all things. And we sailed around and looked for countries to take us in and found virtually none. But it's a very fun, cool COVID story. And I was trapped with 500 of my favorite age group. So,
were you like on the ship as like a guest, I'll be here for a week speaker, or had you signed up for a semester?
I'd signed up for the whole thing. I brought my kids. We were going to see the world. We spent the first 3 weeks crossing the Pacific, which was super cool. And then we got to Japan and we spent 4 days in Japan. And then we got a message on our cell phones when we were in Japan that there was this, you know, strange flu-like illness in China, which was our next stop. So we said, okay, we'll skip China and, you know, then we're good, right? Because we'll just skip China and then we're fine. And so we sailed another 2 weeks-ish. I can't remember now. Got to Vietnam. And then, you know, everything really blew up over there. This was in February. So it was before here, you know, in the U.S. And so then another country didn't let us in until Africa. South Africa was the next country that let us in. So we were sailing around from Vietnam to South Africa.
When did you finally get home?
We were let off in South Africa and they, you know, the powers that be rightly said to the students, like, y'all need to immediately go home, which they did. My husband was coming to South Africa to meet us as part of the journey. So we were kind of waiting for him. And then they went on lockdown. So we were locked down in South Africa for 4 to 6 weeks, and actually got out with an embassy flight. So we had the whole big adventure, but it was, you know, I've been on semester at sea since then, I wanted a COVID-free voyage. Mm-hmm. And it was very cool to have a COVID-free voyage. But I have to say, I have a special place in my heart for all my spring 2020 voyagers. Like, we had a really unique experience, you know, kind of going through that together of all the uncertainty and how do you cope, and, you know, metaphor for life. And so, I mean, everybody has their COVID learning moments, and those were mine.
How old are your kids when you did that?
They were in middle school when we did it with COVID, and then we just did it again last year. So they were in high school by that time.
That is the coolest thing.
It's very cool. Yeah, it's very cool. So they've been to 22 countries, and mostly through educational venues, not just through, like, you know, luxury tours or whatever. So it's, I love semester at sea. It's just such a great opportunity to see the world, but in an educational context, not just in a let's hit the beach context.
Yes, I did. I studied abroad in college, and I actually went a couple times in high school as well under the guise of studying Spanish, which I did study Spanish,
nice.
But I also just really wanted to travel.
Good for you.
And then the year after I graduated from college, I backpacked around the world and did humanitarian work and in 12 different countries.
Oh, nice.
So it was similar. Cool. And I had some friends do the do semester at sea. So I'm totally familiar. And
yeah, it sounds like it.
So that's neat.
I didn't know that about you, Stephanie.
It's really cool. I'm like, oh man, I need to tell my husband that. He's going to be like, okay, how do you get on?
Well, call me later and I'll tell you what I know.
Amazing. Oh my gosh. This is one of those moments. It is a massive honor to have you on the show today. I read your book, The Defining Decade, maybe 10 years ago.
The first edition came out in 2012.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think I read it right when it came out, but I read it a couple of years later, and I have recommended it to absolutely everybody. I have a book coming out actually at the end of April, and it's not about 20 somethings necessarily. It's more about kind of 25 to 35-ish. Uh-huh. And so many of, like, I really feel like the defining decade was such a, like, push forward in that.
Good.
So I'm just so, so, so happy to have you on the show. I want to ask you to kind of, like, get us started with why the 20-something years are so important. Like, we kind of think they're this, but actually they're this. Walk us through that.
Yeah. So, I think for several decades now, really starting with my generation, I'm a Gen Xer. So adult milestones have begun to happen sort of later than they, quote, used to. And so it kind of led to this saying or this belief of, like, 30's the new 20, you know, that all the stuff that people used to do around the age of 20, you know, back in the mid-1900s, they're now doing closer to the age of 30. So if 30's the new 20, then, oh, whatever, you know, what you do in your 20s doesn't matter. Actually matters a ton. And kind of to the point on your time frame that, I mean, I talk about working with 20-somethings, but really, you know, 18 to 35 is just an enormous developmental sweet spot. So much is happening. So I'll rattle off some stats for you of all the stuff that happens by 35, but an estimated 80% of life's most defining moments take place by age 35. And, you know, how can that be true? Well, we know that the jobs we have in our 20s, our learning curve at work in our 20s predicts our earning curve in our 30s and beyond. Average age of marriage is about 29 these days in the U.S. Average age of first child is about 30 these days in the U.S. About half of 20-somethings find their purpose by around the age of 30 or 35. We know that fertility peaks, you know, somewhere in the years of 20s, early 30s. We know that the brain is capping off its last major growth spurt in the 20s, which makes it a great time to learn new skills and to really sort of develop as a person. And then related to the fact that so much about life is changing while your brain is changing, your personality changes more in your 20s than any other time in life, because your brain is literally rewiring itself based on its experiences. So, you know, people ask me all the time, like, why do you work with 20-somethings? And the answer to me is that's where all the action is. That if you want to get in on, you know, people's most defining moments, that's when you work with them, is before they're making those or as they're making those decisions. So it's a super rewarding time to work with people. And it's a very easy time to change your life. So sometimes people panic and they say, oh no, I'm 29. I can't possibly change my life now. Not true. We all just have to start where we are. But, you know, really anywhere in that 18 to 35 sweet spot, a lot can happen really quickly.
I'm a little stuck here because I truly have read your book like several times. So
you're like, yeah, I know all that. Yeah.
No, I'm like, okay, well, how do I, oh man, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that. Can you give us like, just, I feel like the good news is that really, like, the paint is still wet. You really can change so much so quickly, as you just said, but I know that a lot of people come to your books and come to your, like, you know, office for therapy who are like with some like regrets about things that they maybe didn't do sooner. Can you give us just like a little bit of the like picture of what happens if we don't use our 20s?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it just, the longer you wait to do things, the more you have to do in a shorter period of time. So, you know, I think, you know, regret is something I wouldn't spend a ton of time on, because that's just sort of comparing, you know, what you did to this fantasy of everything you could have done perfectly, if only you had had perfect information, which none of us ever have. But I think that if, you know, if you go by the 30 is the new 20 mantra, which I think most people know better these days, but, you know, if you take that literally, that means, oh, I can just start everything at 30 and still have time for everything. And you might, but it's going to be very crunched, and you're going to have a lot to do in your 30s, a lot of really big stuff. So if you're interested in having a career, if you're interested in having a relationship, you're interested in having a family, to start all those things at 30, you are really, really going to have your feet to the fire all throughout your 30s, which is not fun. So, you know, I really encourage people not to get all that stuff done by the time they're 30, but to certainly have started, you know, sort of their long form projects. So, people, what is it I think I want to do with my life? Who do I want to be? Who do I want to love? What does my family makeup look like? And, you know, what am I waiting for? Why don't I get started? Doesn't mean you have to finish it all, but you should probably start it.
Yeah.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I know that, you know, with something like career, it's intimidating to go like, oh, I'm supposed to start my career right now. Like, I remember reading that and going, well, I feel like I sort of made a mistake then, because I spent several years in the very middle and really towards the end of my 20s doing jobs that paid like absolutely nothing. But one of the things you talk about is identity capital, not like you don't need to go out and be an Insta CEO. That's not what we're talking about. Tell us what identity capital is.
Yeah. So identity capital is a really useful concept. It's not mine. It's just I'm the middleman that I kind of bring it to the population that needs to know about it most. But it's a really useful way to think about what you're doing with work in your 20s is you don't need to know who am I going to be once and forever, because careers don't even work that way anymore. So your average 20-something will have 9 different jobs by the age of 35.
So, I'm so tired hearing that.
I know. I feel like in my 20s, at some points, I felt like I had 9 jobs at one time. But so there's a lot's going to happen. And so you don't have to think about, is this it forever? Is this me forever? Just think about moving from one good piece of identity capital at a time. So that's really opportunities where you can learn and grow and sort of add value to who you are, add skills to your, you know, skill sets that you can take with you to the next job with the next bit of identity capital. So an example, you know, semester at sea is an example, backpacking around the world is an example. So it was my first job out of college was working as an outward bound instructor. And, you know, it's probably not the most ambitious thing I could have done right after I graduated from University of Virginia, but I wanted some life experience. I wanted to see some of the world. I wanted to grow up some, have some responsibilities. And it ended up being a really good source of identity capital for me. I learned a lot about leadership and self-direction and managing groups and managing myself. And so when I, you know, kind of when the capital on that had run out for me, I decided, okay, time for grad school. And I actually had an easier time getting into grad school, I think, than many other people, because I had done something really interesting with tons of identity capital. That was what everybody wanted to talk about when I did my interviews. So, you know, when people hear identity capital, they think, oh no, you know, I need to go work in a lawyer's office and have a briefcase. And that's not necessarily what I'm talking about. It depends on what do you want to do and what are sources of learning and growth for you.
Yeah. I wonder, when I was getting ready to go to college, I remember one time, I need to ask my mom what happened with this, but one time I sat down with like a college advisor or something, and I truly only met with him once. I remember him like leaning back in his chair and saying, "So what makes you an interesting person?" And I'm
nice.
Like, I am 17 and a half years old. Like, I've been hustling my buns, trying to be in every sport, every, you know, club, every whatever, trying to make my resume as impressive as possible. And I said like, well, I do this and I do this and I do this. And he goes, so does everyone else. What makes you interesting? And I just like totally like, deer in the headlights, had nothing to say.
Burst into tears, years of extracurriculars for nothing.
Yeah, like that. And that's the end of the story. Truly. But I did, like, as you're saying this, I'm thinking, I wonder if it's less impressive and more interesting. That, like, it doesn't have to be, like, whatever you want to put, or, like, whatever I thought that guy was going to be looking for on my, you know, college
resume.
Application.
Yeah. When I went to Berkeley to clinical psych PhDs, it's very competitive to get in. And so I think my year is probably the same now. They got about 500 applications and they take 5.
Oh,
and so how do you get to be one of the 5? I mean, I was the only one of the 5. I mean, UVA is no slouch of a school, but I was the only one of the 5 that didn't go to an Ivy League undergrad. And a lot of them had research papers and posters at conferences and, you know, had kind of done the resume impressive stuff. But, and I wouldn't have been able to compete just on those terms, certainly not after tromping around in the woods for 5 years. But, you know, I had something that they didn't have, which was a lot of life experience. You know, if you want to be a psychologist, I mean, you kind of have to know how to handle people in difficult situations more than you have to know, you know, how to give a good poster session. So, so I think that idea of what makes you interesting is much more important than what makes you impressive, because, you know, after people might find someone impressive, but they pretty quickly want to move on to interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially if they're going to partner with you or hire you, you know, they want you to be an interesting person to have around.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the other things that you talk about that the person I was talking to just before this is a dear friend of mine, Carly, and she was the one who gave me the defining decade. And she talks about the power of weak ties all the time. And she just mentioned it.
Cool.
So can you tell us what that means? Because that is just, it's fascinating to me what the power of weak ties.
Yeah, again, not my concept. So that title, so The Strength of Weak Ties is the title of a paper, an important paper that was written, you know, I think it was in the 90s, 80s. It was a while ago, long before there was such a thing as a social network. But it was really about the power of social networks and about how our strong ties, so our closest family and friends, they might be our most supportive figures, but they're not our most transformative figures. That most of the big changes in our lives come from people who are outside of our inner circle. So those are called our weak ties. So that's like your old roommate's neighbor, your friend from camps, sister, you know, the person you used to work for, the professor you used to have, the, you know, old roommate you used to have. It's just all the people that we know and all the people that they know. So it's, you know, it's really kind of no end to our network of weak ties. But what's so cool about weak ties is that because they're far out in our social networks, they tend to be different than we are because we kind of cluster together with people that are like us and people we talk to a lot. And so we're all kind of in agreement on everything and we know what everybody thinks already. But when you talk to weak ties, you get an opportunity to learn new information, have different ideas, different perspectives. So, you know, I won't bore you with the details, but they've done some cool research about how, you know, most people get leads from new jobs from weak ties because, I mean, you already know everything your best friend knows, but if you talk to someone new and you tell them, oh man, I'm looking for a job in this or that field, they'll say, oh, have you thought about calling such and such? Or, you know, my sister used to do that. You should have coffee with her. And that's really how, I mean, that's where everything comes from. So if I think in my own life about every apartment I ever had, every job, every good idea I ever had, everything that I've had has come from some conversation that I had with someone, a weak tie, that sparked something that I wouldn't have been able to come up with on my own.
Ideas are one thing and exchanging information. But when it comes to like new jobs or apartments or, I mean, even like dating.
Definitely.
It takes some, like, I guess, how do we use our weak ties? Because that feels weird. That feels weird to call my in-laws friend and be like, hey, got any jobs?
I mean, it does take some courage, but it is how the world goes round. And so, you know, I was also on something earlier today myself. I was giving a talk for a company for young workers. And I was saying, talk to people outside of your team, talk to people who are older than you in your company, talk to people at other companies that you're interested in, you know, what do they do? I think, you know, just being curious is a really good position in life. I mean, as a therapist, I try to be very curious about my clients' lives before I start telling them what to do. and, you know, I think if you, you know, respectfully approach someone or reach out to someone and say, I'm really curious about what you do. I'm thinking about moving in that direction myself. Can I buy you coffee? You know, actually, I had a client who said she was having a hard time branching out socially. And I said, well, is there anyone who kind of does some cool things that you wish you did? And she said, yeah, so-and-so. I said, well, why don't you ask her for lunch and say, I'm really curious about how you get involved in all these cool things. I would like to do more of that. So, I mean, who doesn't want to hear that what they're doing is sort of worth emulating or that people could learn from that? So I think what many people don't understand is that people who are in a position of, quote, power, you know, they have something you want, whether it's a better social life or a better job. it's easy for them to help you. So, I mean, now that I know so much about 20-somethings or psychology grad school or whatever, it's very easy for me to help someone. And I'm generally happy to do it as long as I have the time. And I think, you know, most people feel the same. And, you know, maybe everybody doesn't, but you don't need everybody to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The last thing, unless I come up with something else, that I want to ask you about from the defining decade, that is just like, you talk about the, I don't know if this is like the right umbrella for it, but you talk about dating and how important it is to carefully select your future spouse, because people say you can't make your family. And you're like, no, but you can. And this mm-hmm. is when you are.
When you do, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a big shift that happened. I mean, a lot of big shifts happen in your 20s, and that's why I love working with that age group. But one of the big ones is, you know, you grow up your whole life hearing, you know, well, you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends. And that's true until you're about 25 or 30 or 35 or whatever point you decide that, hey, I want to create a family of my own. Like, you get to choose. Who do you love? How do you love? What does your family look like? What does my partner's family look like? You know, you are suddenly picking the family that one day your kids are going to say, well, you can't pick your family, but you can't pick your friends. You're picking it. So I think just that paradigm shift around, you actually do choose your family and choosing your partner and choosing what your family is going to be about and what it's going to look like and who your in-laws are. Those are your choices. So, you know, to kind of help people realize that they can be as intentional about that as they are about work, you know, that I think we all understand, oh, you know, graduate school would be useful, or I need to have 2 or 3 good jobs to really build up my skill level. But then relationships, we just kind of stumble around and like go with the energy or the chemistry, and, you know, can often maybe not be as thoughtful or as intentional about relationships as we are about work.
What are some things that we, realizing that, I mean, that is a giant paradigm shift to go like, you're dating right now. Yes. Currently, you know, if this is what you decide to do and this is how, like, and it all goes this way, like, you're choosing your kids' parents.
Right. Right.
Like, that is giant. That is really hard to wrap our minds around. What are some things that, like, therefore...
Right. Therefore what?
Yeah.
And now what? You know, I think just an important thing to think about is... I mean, maybe this has gotten a little better, I would like to hope, since I wrote The Defining Decade. But I think for a while, it was a bit taboo to sort of take relationships seriously. That seemed like a little bit retro of, you know, oh, what do you mean? You know, you're in your 20s and you're talking about getting married, or you want to find a partner, or a, you know, that just seemed kind of old school and people weren't doing that anymore. And I think, or all that, like, I hear people say this a lot. Oh, I tell my kids not to get married till 30. And I'm like, I don't have a date on it of what is the right or wrong age. But I think when you say that, you're kind of inviting them to not take their relationships in their 20s very seriously, because they think like, oh, well, I'm not mature enough to really think about this till I'm 30. But, you know, I think it takes a lot of courage and to, you know, listen to yourself and say, oh, I do want more than a hookup or a situationship or whatever the case may be. You know, I want a partner. I think I want a family, and that might take some time. And so, you know, I'm going to date someone carefully. And if things aren't going well, I'm going to listen to myself and change course the same way I would change a job. So, you know, 9 jobs by the age of 35. I don't know if you'll have 9 relationships in your 20s, but it's a similar process, or it should be, where you try your best to choose a good one, but if it's not going well, you need to change course rather than feel like, well, I don't want to be alone, or, oh no, everybody's getting married, so I guess we're just going to do this. I had somebody tell me, you know, last week of, oh, well, we've already been together 3 years, so I can't, you know, end it now. And I said, so you're going to go 50 more? I mean, you know, that makes no sense. That if you know, the data coming back is this isn't making me happy. This isn't what I want. Then it's time to, you know, choose more wisely next time. Yeah. So one of my supervisors said something to me once, which is the best time to work on your marriage is before you have one. And you know, that's really what my work with 20 somethings is about. It's not about, I don't have an agenda that people should get married younger or older or anything. That's really up to you to decide. But just that for people to work on their marriages before they have them. So that by the time they do have the family they've chosen, they feel good about it.
Yeah. I really love that. You have a new book coming out. When? Tell me again when it comes out.
Yeah, April 9th. It's called The 20-Something Treatment, and the subtitle is A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it is explicitly 20-something mental health. So interestingly, when I was writing The Defining Decade, so that was the first edition came out in 2012. The second edition of it came out in 2021 and actually has a whole big chapter on 29 conversations to have with your partner, by the way. So there's a lot of relationship stuff in there, a lot more social media stuff. But anyway, when I was writing the first edition, I'm a clinical psychologist, so I kept trying to talk about mental health. And my editor, you know, kept saying that, no, don't do that, that, you know, talk about stuff that your average 20-something can relate to. And I said, well, I hate to break it to you, but your average 20-something, you know, has mental health struggles. I mean, you know, as we do. But he said, you know, just that's another book. Like, you want The Defining Decade to be sort of the what to expect when you're expecting of your 20s, you know, your sort of post-graduation manual. And he was totally right about that. And he was totally right that people weren't really talking, I mean, other than psychologists, people weren't really talking about mental health, you know, 15 years ago. I mean, the word was like just very clunky. No one was even using it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, everyone is talking about mental health and young adult mental health, but some of the conversations are better than others. So I wanted to write something about what 25 years of working with 20-something mental health has taught me that I could share, because I don't think the answer for everyone is finding a therapist. There aren't enough that are accessible and affordable. It's not a scalable profession. Most people don't need a therapist, but, you know, I tried to put in the 20-something treatment, you know, what is kind of my age-specific approach to 20-something mental health and how I work with young adults specifically.
I'm so curious about that. So my background, both my parents are licensed psychologists, which is like a super weird thing. It's really not that weird, but I guess I'm the only one I know. And so I really have been entrenched in this mental health world, you know, for my whole life. I feel like I would say everyone needs a therapist. Why not? And so
why not? Is because the money. I mean, that's why not. So everybody could benefit from a good therapist. I mean, everybody, because I mean, like, why not?
Right.
Most people cannot afford a good therapist. So the reason I've written books, I mean, this is my third book, and all of my books are really to say, this is everything I've got on this topic for $20 or a library card, because I really believe in, you know, education as an intervention and that a lot of people can be helped. You know, like you were saying, you felt very helped or impacted by The Defining Decade and you didn't need to sit down one-on-one with me week after week to make that happen. So,
So they could benefit from it, but it's not... But it's just, it's not as realistic. So,
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what are the things that you have, I guess, gosh, this is like an enormous question. Sorry about this. what are some of the things that you have learned about 20-somethings mental health that like we need to get from this book?
Yeah. You know, a couple of things. I mean, there's sort of three routes to better mental health that I talk about in the book and just in my work. One I just talked about is education, that a lot of people are helped just by understanding things better, understanding how the brain works, or, you know, how worrying works, or how decisions work, or how love works. You know, that education can go a long way, and that you can get from a book. Another route to better mental health is expectations. And so a lot of people have heard, you know, your 20s are going to be the best years of your life. Empirically speaking, your 20s are not going to be the best years of your life, but there's actually a J-shaped mental health curve that kind of goes throughout life, where from childhood down through teens into our 20s, our kind of well-being declines because life gets harder. I mean, we're, you know, we have to deal with more and more, and we're kind of overwhelmed by, you know, the stressors outdo our, you know, our coping. So mental health tends to bottom out in our 20s. And then the good news is it goes up from there. So life gets better, you know, well-being, life satisfaction, mental health, depression, anxiety, pretty much all the measures get better in 30s, 40s, 50s, and so on. So I think sometimes it helps for people to understand that they're not doing something wrong, that nothing is wrong with them, that, you know, if you're struggling in your 20s, it doesn't mean you're always going to struggle. It's a very difficult time because so much is happening and so much is up in the air. And, you know, I tell my clients, your 20s, you know, probably aren't going to be the best years of your life, but you don't want them to be. Like, if your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something has gone terribly wrong, because you really want, what you want to do in your 20s is lay the foundation for life just to get better and better. You don't want to peak in your 20s. So, so that's an important thing to understand, that it's very normal to struggle in your 20s. And we can talk a bit more about why that is. The third route that I talk a lot about in the 20-something treatment to better mental health is experience. And this is kind of goes back to the therapist question, that they did some interesting research on why do people get better in therapy. And so there's this, you know, kind of cool pie chart that shows the factors. But the biggest slice of client improvement, so 40% of client improvement in therapy, comes from outside factors. So the new job, the better roommate, the new friends, the different relationship with their family, the, you know, kind of the outside life experience factors are actually what helps people be healthier and happier in their 20s. I mean, just talking about things only goes so far. So, you know, I tell clients, you know, mental health tends to get better when life gets better. And so as we kind of help our 20-something life along, our mental health will follow. But, you know, in the years where you're trying to sort all that out, it can be really challenging.
Yeah. Why are our 20-something years so hard? You said we can talk more about that.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of goes a little bit to the subtitle of the book, which is a revolutionary remedy for an uncertain age. And that is that our 20s are the most uncertain decade of life. And again, I'm speaking like 18 to 35-ish. But it's really the only time in your life where you'll wake up in the morning and you may not know where you'll live in 5 years, or if anybody's going to love you in 5 years, or if you'll ever have a family or be able to pay your bills, or if you're ever going to be happy, or what you're going to do for work. It's really the only time of life when you wake up in the morning and all of that is uncertain. And the brain does not like that. The brain perceives uncertainty as danger. And, you know, then what follows? Stress, anxiety, depression, you know, substance use to cope, blah, blah, blah. So it's a very challenging time of life. It's much easier, take it from me, to be decades past your 20s. And of course, anything could happen tomorrow. I don't know. But I do wake up in the morning and I have the answers to those questions. I know who I'm going to be when I grow up. I know how many kids I'm going to have. I know who my partner is. I know that I can pay my bills. And that's psychologically a much easier place to be than wondering and worrying about whether that's going to happen.
Yeah. What are, like, if you could give every 20-something like two tools to hold on to get through these uncertain years, what would those be?
Well, see now, they would be these.
My two books.
For people who can't see, I just held up my two books. They would be those because I'm really not peddling the book, but I genuinely, the defining decade is really about sort of making the most of your time, that it's a very important time developmentally. And here's everything I know about what to do with that time and how to think about that time. And then the 20-something treatment is really about, normalizing the fact that it's a difficult time and, kind of teaching people that mental health is going to get better as life gets better. And this is sort of how you can move that process along.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like in the defining decade, like the tool I would pull from it probably is like, start now. Like it doesn't have to be perfect. Start now.
Yeah.
And your whole future self will be so much happy, will like benefit so much from the imperfect start. You don't have to finish today, but just get started
just
today.
Just start, yeah. I mean, if you think about anything, whether you've got a paper to write that you're thinking, oh my gosh, how am I going to write that 15 pages? Or a workout to do that you think, I really don't want to row for 40 minutes. It's always just start. Just start. That's always the answer. And then you can quit, you can change course, you can, see how it goes. But I mean, the answer is always to just start. So I do think that's a great takeaway from the defining decade. And I think for the 20-something treatment, it's really to, understand that struggles are normal and that it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you and that life can and will get better in your 20s and certainly beyond.
Is it the kind of thing where I really appreciate that because I think that having a problem is like one thing, thinking your problem is a problem, or thinking is your fault. Like of that just makes it so much worse. So I really appreciate that. Is it the kind of thing where I know you said that our mental health gets better because of things outside the therapy room. So it's like when you get a better job, it gets better. Are there any specific things that you found to do this to improve your life outside of the therapy room and your life will get better and your mental health will get better? Or is it kind of just like a waited out sort of thing?
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, time is probably on your side, but it's not really a waited out because remember, it's experience. It's like life gets better probably because you do something to make life better, not just because life inherently gets better. So in the 20-something treatment, there's a whole middle section called, the first section's called Why Now, which is like, why are my dang 20s so hard, which we just talked about. And then the middle section is Now What? And there's 12 how-tos, and it's everything from how to think to how to feel, how to cook, how to move. I have how to have sex in there, how to love, how to work, how to befriend, how to be social, that I really go through all the ways that you are able and responsible to make your life better. So that then you'll feel happier and healthier. So it really is about, how do I do life? How do I do my 20-something life in a way that sort of builds up my mental health and builds my skills?
Yeah,